Blog Talk Radio.
Live to see it, friends. You're listening to Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Fast Forward Radio is an audio production of The Speculist, and you can find us online at speculist.com. That's speculist.com. Or you can go straight to the blog at blog.speculist.com. At The Speculist and on Fast Forward Radio, we talk about what's happening in the world today and where the world is going, and we're not afraid to take a kind of a contrarian view, to wit. If you're not excited about the future, you're not paying attention. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-host, co-blogger, and co-futurist, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you?
I'm super fantastic. How are you, Stephen?
Well, a little bit bummed. I had tried to alter our front bumper music. It had happy birthday, and then it went into our normal little can thing, and obviously it didn't do that. So I somehow messed that up. Happy birthday, Phil.
Well, thank you very much. That's very nice of you. Very nice to, you know, it's the thought that counts. I'll always remember that bumper music as having happy birthday at the beginning. Nice of you to remember my birthday, actually. This is actually an auspicious day. You know, August 31st is, in addition to being my birthday, our buddy Harvey wrote to let me know that this is also Queen Rania of Jordan's birthday.
Awesome.
I think she's probably younger than me, is my guess. And in addition to that, this is Merdeka Day. This is Malaysian Independence Day, the anniversary of the day that the British government departed and turned control of Malaysia over to the Malaysian authorities, and it became its own country. So to any Malaysians who are listening,
that
was 51 years ago. They had the big 50th anniversary last year, so if we'd been doing Fast Forward Radio every week last year, we would have caught the big 5-0. But the big 5-1 is pretty exciting too. So I want to say to any Malaysian friends listening, Selamat Hari Merdeka, Malaysia Boleh.
I'm impressed.
That's you know, basically happy Merdeka Day. Malaysia can go, or Malaysia can do it.
Well, of course, I need that.
Yeah, no translation necessary, of course.
Yeah, that's right.
We've also got on the line our chat host for the week, once again, joining us, Michael Sargent. Hello, Michael.
Evening, gentlemen.
How are you?
How are you doing?
Doing well.
Good.
All right. Well, we're eager to see what kind of action we're going to have in the chat room tonight. Based on the fact that it's a holiday weekend, it might get real busy, or it might be kind of slow. We were talking right before the program began. If it slows down, Michael, you just get in an argument with yourself, okay?
I don't think I'll have to do that.
You got some people?
Two audience members at
this
point.
That's right.
Oh, okay. Well, all right. Well, you'll
definitely have to keep me posted. I'm in Arkansas, away from the internet. I'm just calling in from a phone, and so I have no idea what's happening in the chat room. So you have to make sure to let us know.
This is interesting. You are almost completely off the grid here, aren't you?
Yeah.
Your mobile phone doesn't work. Is that right?
And
you got no internet.
That's right. I'm in the woods. It's so deep that the cell phone is not working. I look at the here to see if I've got a bar. No bars, and no internet at all. And I'll let you know where I am. Murfreesboro, Arkansas is the name of the town, and this is the only place in the United States where diamonds can be found.
Is that right?
Yeah, it's got a diamond mine here, and it was. They thought about commercializing it and having, you know, commercial diamond production here, and just never did it. And back during World War II, it was going to be an important source of diamonds since Africa was sort of cut off to us for a time.
Right.
Basically now it is a state park, and you can come pay a small fee and go out and hunt for diamonds. And small diamonds are found every day, and big diamonds are found periodically. One of the big ones, I mean, we're talking about diamonds that you could just about retire on. They're so big. Hillary Clinton wore one of the big ones to the inaugural balls with Bill Clinton. The Star of Arkansas, I think, is what she was wearing. But it's kind of a neat deal. And from time to time, I get out there and hunt. Just on the off chance, I may get lucky.
Isn't that amazing?
Have you got the boys out there yet?
Oh, yeah. We have a good time when we go out there, too. We try to do it on a day where the sun is not beating down too bad. Just take our shovels out there. And a raw diamond, you have to know what you're looking for because it's not, you know, it doesn't look like it's ready to be set in a ring. It's different. It's sort of a clear
stone. In the rough.
Yeah, it's definitely in the rough.
Wow.
Diamonds in the rough is about a theme on this show.
No doubt.
All too appropriate. Yeah, that should be a transition of some kind, I think. Well, good luck. You know, I would say since you noted that the boys are going to be off school for a couple days, I would get them up early and you know, have them out there all day looking is you know, it would be my advice.
That's exactly right.
Yeah. Just you know, they can
like the original
spend their time very productively.
You know.
Yeah, looking for big diamonds out there in Arkansas. So,
now
you're in Arkansas on vacation, but normally you're, of course, in Louisiana, and
right.
We wanted to get your perspective on the very serious conditions down in the Gulf Coast with Hurricane Gustav, and how are things looking for your hometown? I guess probably Shreveport's going to be okay, but what have you heard or Grapevine or whatever about what's going on in New Orleans or elsewhere?
Shreveport, of course, is in North Louisiana, and it's going to be just fine. It's going to get a whole lot of rain in my hometown,
mm-hmm.
but New Orleans could be in trouble. The Louisiana governor, Bobby Jindal, has evacuated the entire Louisiana coastline with, you know, millions of people, basically, and have left. And people after Katrina and Rita hit Louisiana, I think 3 years ago now. You know, after that experience, people listened and got out. But the deal is, if the storm hits just right or wrong, I guess at the mouth of the Mississippi, it would push water into Lake Pontchartrain, and then basically swamp New Orleans. And coming on the heels of Katrina like that, it seems to me that if it were to happen that way, that it could be a psychological breaking point for the city and New Orleans could end up being a much smaller city than it's been in the past, if that's the case. So if you're a praying person in the audience, pray for New Orleans. It could be bad. But anyway, the good news I've heard just in the last couple hours is that the storm is not expected to hit in the precise wrong way, and that the city probably is going to be able to weather this one. Of course, they strengthened their levees and everything after Katrina, and so we're expected to get through it, but, you know, we're just got our fingers crossed.
Yeah, well, and we all do, bated breath here, holding our breath, hoping that that the worst isn't realized. Now, I was watching CNN just before coming up here to start setting up for the program this evening, and it looks like, yeah, the projection now is that it will probably, the landfall of the storm will not be right at the mouth of the Mississippi, right at New Orleans. It'll probably be a little bit west of there, and it seems like it's creeping further and further west of there as they keep talking. So also, it has fallen from a Category 4 back to a 3, and perhaps it'll continue to dissipate from there. We can only hope.
Right. And since people have been so good to get out of there this time, the loss of life should be minimal. And so, you know, let's as you said, hope for the best.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Well, certainly it raises the issue of, you know, what is the, if we were to spin this into a fast-forward radio discussion, what is the future of dealing with the weather in this kind of way and dealing with, you know, you and I were talking earlier today about this, and to a certain extent, there are analogies with the technology that has been deployed in the Netherlands for hundreds of years with, you know, with the dikes to keep areas that were reclaimed from the sea that are at or below sea level from being overwhelmed by the sea, and they're looking now for the city of Venice to find ways to, use that kind of technology to keep it from what's happening there is it's just slowly sinking into the water. So the question is that kind of technology, do you think, on the horizon for New Orleans? Is that something that they are or should be looking at? Do you think that the levees that the Corps of Engineers that they're working on, will that be sufficient? Or what are your thoughts from a futures of New Orleans standpoint, technologically speaking?
Well, starting with the distant past, the French Quarter was all that there was to New Orleans in the beginning. It was built on the highest ground that they had in that area, and it's above sea level. And the French Quarter, after Katrina, was high and dry. It was an area, and because it was above sea level. And in some ways, technology is part of the problem. We have the technology to build below the sea level at this point now, and that's what most of New Orleans is. It's below the sea level. And if it were in the Netherlands, where there's no hurricanes, you wouldn't have this problem. But periodically, you're going to get a big hurricane come through, and that's the danger of New Orleans. And so what do you do? I guess you build your levee system and pumps and everything else bigger, stronger all the time. And I think that they had gotten a little lax, perhaps, before Katrina. And then after Katrina, they had begun to strengthen and raise and work on those systems. And my understanding was that they were nowhere near done before, this one comes along. So
hopefully we'll
weather this one and then have completed the work before the next big one hits. So.
Right. Yeah, my understanding is what the Corps of Engineers is doing currently is scheduled to be done in about 2 years.
Right.
So if the hurricane could have held off an extra couple of years, that would have been great. But, of course, they don't
– You roll the dice every hurricane season,
Yeah,
and,
absolutely.
And, for the last really, New Orleans has not been in danger the last few years from any of these storms. But here we go. We got a good, a big one. And that's sort of took aim at New Orleans, and hopefully we'll miss it.
I wonder if there's also a comparison with Galveston, right, which was completely wiped out by a storm. What was that,
right,
in the 1930s? Is that right? And then subsequently
earlier
they
than
built
that,
up.
It was right at the turn of the century, turn of the 20th.
Okay.
It was right after that. But yeah, it thousands of people were killed, and after that they built the Galveston seawall. And Galveston has never had, fortunately, I don't know that any single disaster has killed more people than that flood in Galveston.
Yeah, that was a terrible
one. That was the big
one. But the wall seems to have been effective since then.
That's right.
And I hope, actually, I expect
that Galveston
is
above sea level, though. I think that's part of their secret is that I don't think that it's necessarily that. New Orleans is particularly, built in a particularly dangerous way. That's what you have. That's the land. That's the land that's available there.
It's absolutely.
Slow.
Yeah.
So.
People have decided it's a nice place to live, and I think they will continue to live there. Let me tell you why I think that's the case. I got to thinking about this after you and I talked about it this afternoon. And there is a great short story by Doris Lessing, who won the Nobel Prize for Literature a couple years ago. But back in the day, she used to write science fiction. And she wrote a terrific story about the aliens come down and make first contact with humanity. And among other bits of good information they have for us is they come to the city of San Francisco and say, "Look, we've looked, and you're sitting on a huge fault. You people need to get out of here because there's going to be an earthquake, and it will kill you all." And, of course, the people in San Francisco go, "Yeah, we know. We know there's a big fault. We know there's going to be a big earthquake, but we like it here, so we continue to live here anyway." And, it ends with the aliens just kind of scratching their head. It's like, why would people live someplace where they know that bad things are going to happen? But it seems to be part of human nature that that we will occupy places that we want to, irrespective of the risk involved. I think the other great example that comes to mind is Naples, sitting right there at the foot of Mount Vesuvius. You know, you go up the road if you want to and take a look at Pompeii. I mean, it's you couldn't have a bigger, more dramatic warning that if that volcano blows, you're hosed, right? But what do you got? 2 million people living in Naples anyway. So I think people will continue to live in these kinds of places, and our technology is therefore going to be driven to be better and better to deal with them. I don't know what we're going to do about a volcano. That's a bigger problem, I think, even than being a little below sea level and being hit by hurricanes. But I think one way or another, we'll continue to live in these places, and that will drive us to have better and better technology to deal with it.
No doubt.
That's my optimistic prediction on it. Well, this is Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. We're talking about various topics related to the future this evening. And if you'd like to join us, you can give us a call at 347-215-8972 or join our online chat. And I see that we actually have a caller, so I'm going to bring the caller on. Hello, caller.
Hello, you there?
Yes, we are.
Hello, it's Pastor Pat. I wanted to call in. I've just enjoyed your show so much, I thought I'll call in. And you know what one of these things is? It's American stubbornness. When we put a city somewhere, we make it work no matter what. Las Vegas is one of the fastest growing cities in America, and it's in the middle of a desert.
You're absolutely right. That's a good point.
New Orleans is below sea level, with Lake Pontchartrain above it, and it's in the path of hurricanes, but we just keep building dikes higher and higher. I mean, we've got cities on fault lines. I mean, it's crazy, but as Americans, that's our home. We'll spend billions and billions and billions of dollars to make New Orleans work instead of abandoning it. You know, and there's no real logical reason for it. You had brought up, you know, Holland, but that's different. They had a land shortage, and they had to reclimate the land with windmills and things to get more livable space. And in Venice, you had mentioned Venice, that was a way for those people to live there, and they really couldn't be attacked because they only knew the way in and out. And Venice actually worked. They used to tear down the buildings and then build on top, and they kept going up, up, up. And then they got on this kick of preservation of these old buildings, and now they're sinking. They're going to have to spend billions and billions. But, you know, I think it's just American stubbornness. This is our home, and we're going to live here. You know, I mean, there's no
I don't know if it's American stubbornness or just the stubbornness of humanity, you know.
Oh,
that's
yeah.
Just,
well,
that's just human nature, isn't it?
You know, there's a Russian city up way up there in the Arctic that has, like, over 1 million people. And they figured it up, and they could put every citizen up in the finest hotel in Moscow year-round cheaper than what it costs to have that many people living that far north, you know. And it's just, we're going to live here. You know, we're talking about going to Mars. We're going to spend billions and billions and billions of dollars to step on a lifeless rock, you know.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned Mars, Pastor Pat, because I think that's exactly where this takes us. It's if we insist on living in environments that are so inhospitable, and you think about the settlements in Antarctica, right? I mean, that
oh,
must
sure.
be a tremendous expenditure devoted to keeping those up and running. But we're going to do it. We're going to have people living in Antarctica, and eventually I think we will send people to Mars, and we'll have people living on Mars, and it'll be part of this same kind of drive to, well, if we've decided we want to be someplace, that's where we're going to go, and that's where we're going to be.
Well, let's say I take you back in time, 300 years, and I take you to the middle of the Valley of the Sun, right in the heart of downtown Phoenix, 300 years ago. And if I told you there's going to be a sprawling metropolis here of over 1 million people, how hard would you laugh?
Right.
You know,
right.
I think we probably, I'm almost positive we'll live on Antarctica because there's air and water, and then, but the moon and Mars, I don't know, but... You know, it's going to be interesting because I read a book by a fellow back in the 60s, and he said that even if we lifted 5,000 people a day off Earth to live somewhere else, you know, Moon, Mars, orbit, take your pick, he said it wouldn't be enough to even dent the population problem. So I think it's interesting, but I don't think it's an answer. I mean, it was such an interesting book, and the guy never got any press, but... He's right, you know, 5,000 is a drop in the bucket, you know, and 5,000 a day is probably optimistic, you know.
Well, 5,000 a day into space would be a huge engineering undertaking if we were...
Right, which is probably not even possible, which wouldn't help our problem is my point, you know. Overpopulation, we need to control the... we need to control how many kids we have, because China implemented that and was very successful, and they had to lighten up on it, because the reason their system works is overpopulation. If you have tons of people fighting for a job, they're willing to work for anything. If you have a very small group of people, they're not going to work for a small amount. You know, if there's 5,000 people who want one job, you can charge, you know.
Sure. One of the interesting observations at the Olympic opening ceremony was they had how many people? 10,000 people participating in the show, and you never had any performer repeated. And the actual official party line rationale literally was, yeah, it's not like we're going to run out of people to put in the show, right?
Oh, sure.
I love that.
They've got plenty of people to put in the show. But I'll tell you, if we start talking population, we're going to stray a little far from our topics this evening. That is something I'd like to get back to, because one of the trends that we're tracking is a slowdown in the growth of population. Not that population is slowing, but the growth rate is actually slowing, and it gives us cause to think that in time, as technology develops, as economies develop, that we might see reflected elsewhere in the world what we've seen in Western Europe and in other parts of the developed world, which is that the population growth rate slows to the point that you get somewhere close to replacement, and then some developed parts of the world, Japan in particular, it falls below that, and you actually start to see a population going down. But I think that would be a topic for another day. Well, Pastor Pat, thank you very much. We appreciate your comments.
Oh, no,
thanks for listening.
I enjoyed your show. I wanted to call in. Oh, yes, you have a wonderful show. I love it. And I like how you go from topic to topic. It's fun.
Well, thanks.
If you stay on one topic too long, you just beat that old dead horse. This way, you just whip a few ones, you know.
All right. Well, you keep us honest in the chat room. If we start riding that horse too long, you let us know, okay?
Don't whip that dead horse. That's right.
All right. Thank you, Pastor Pat.
Well, that's about the best segue to the next topic that's possible, I think, Phil. We just need to head on to the next thing, don't we?
Okay, well, yeah, speaking of how we move from topics to topics, what we wanted to get into a little bit next was to talk about the kind of changing landscape as reflected in American politics. I wrote about this in the latest edition of Better All the Time, which was published yesterday on The Speculist. The fact that come November 5th, the U.S. will have elected either its first African-American president or its first woman vice president. One of those two things will happen. And that is a sea change, isn't it? That is a landmark development in American presidential politics, and I believe it reflects on the acceptance of diversity in our society. I think it shows that tremendous progress has been made in that regard. It doesn't say that all problems have been solved or that we now live in utopia, but that we've made some progress in that regard.
Phil, have you seen the Pixar movie Ratatouille?
I have, yes. I'm going to be very interested to see how you connect that to what I just said.
Okay, well, that's the message of Ratatouille. A rat becomes a chef, and this rat's hero, chef, I can't remember the chef's name, anyway, says that anyone can be a chef. And really, the movie goes on to show that, well, maybe not everyone could be a chef or a president or an Olympic athlete or CEO of a Fortune 500 company, but that, a successful person can come from anywhere. Maybe a particular individual doesn't have it in them to become president of the United States, but any person, whether they're a woman or a black person or Asian or any person, has capacity for greatness. And
right.
And that's the power of a meritocracy, and hopefully that's where our country, I think, strives to be. And at its best is a meritocracy, and that's it's a requirement for justice. Martin Luther King Jr. has pointed that out. But it's also a source of strength if we're willing to accept excellence from whoever can deliver it. Then we're going to get excellence much more often, and that's a big deal. And I think that this particular election kind of points that out. that our country
I think so too. Well, yeah. I stand educated by you. You're absolutely right. That was the message of Ratatouille, and I missed it. Okay, I thought I was watching a cartoon about a rat who wanted to be a chef, but you're absolutely right. That is the message of that movie. And you mentioned Dr. King. As a matter of fact, as we all know, when Barack Obama gave his acceptance speech on Thursday evening, that was the 45th anniversary of the I Have a Dream speech, and I thought it would be only appropriate for us to listen to a little bit of that this evening in relation to this topic. So let's listen to Reverend Martin Luther King on the subject of I Have a Dream.
I have a dream that one day this nation will rise up and live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. I have a dream that one day on the red hills of Georgia, the sons of former slaves and the sons of former slave owners will be able to sit down together at the table of brotherhood. I have a dream that one day, even the state of Mississippi, a state sweltering with the heat of injustice, sweltering with the heat of oppression, will be transformed into an oasis of freedom and justice. I have a dream that my four little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. I have a dream today. I have a dream that one day, down in Alabama, with its vicious racists, with its governor having his lips dripping with the words of interposition and nullification. Yes. One day right there in Alabama, little black boys and black girls will be able to join hands with little white boys and white girls as sisters and brothers. I have a dream today. Yes. I have a dream that one day every valley shall be exalted. Every hill and mountain shall be made low, the rough places will be made plain, and the crooked places will be made straight, and the glory of the Lord shall be revealed, and all flesh shall see it together. This is our hope. This is the faith that I go back to the South with. With this faith, we will be able to hew out of the mountain of despair a stone of hope. With this faith, we will be able to transform the jangling discords of our nation into a beautiful symphony of brotherhood. With this faith, we will be able to work together, to pray together, to struggle together, to go to jail together, to stand up for freedom together, knowing that we will be free one day. This will be the day when all of God's children be able to sing with new meaning, my country, tears of thee. Sweet land of liberty, of thee I sing. Land where my fathers died, land of the pilgrim's pride. From every mountainside, let freedom ring. And if America is to be a great nation, this must become true. And so let freedom ring. From the prodigious hilltops of New Hampshire, let freedom ring. From the mighty mountains of New York, let freedom ring. From the heightening Alleghenies of Pennsylvania, let freedom ring. From the snow-capped Rockies of Colorado, let freedom ring. From the curvaceous slopes of California. But not only that, let freedom ring from Stone Mountain of Georgia. Let freedom ring from Lookout Mountain of Tennessee. Let freedom ring from every hill and molehill of Mississippi, from every mountainside. Let freedom ring, and when this happens, when we allow freedom ring, when we let it ring from every village and every hamlet, from every state and every city, we will be able to speed up that day when all of God's children, black men and white men, Jews and Gentiles, Protestants and Catholics, will be able to join hands and sing in the words of the old Negro spiritual, free at last, free at last. Thank God Almighty, we are free at last.
You're listening to Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. We're talking about the future of diversity, and we've just listened to a fairly lengthy segment from the famous I Have a Dream speech by Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King. So what do you make of that, Stephen? I couldn't help, as I was reading over that quote that I had published in the Better All the Time, that here was a speculist, if you will. Here was a man with a vision of the future, a very positive vision of the future that he had to share.
He had optimism. He felt that though the country is flawed, and you know any human society is going to be, that the innate goodness of America could be called upon to address this huge lapse in the American character, and it did. But, by calling on the better angels, I guess, of our nature, he got the change that he was hoping for. It's just a shame he didn't get to live to see it.
Well, it is a shame. Although he talks elsewhere about how he won't get to the mountaintop, but he can describe it to others who would live to see that day. And
he saw it, but he didn't live to see it, but he saw it in his mind's eye. He knew that it was possible.
Exactly.
That's wonderful. It takes visionaries like that, doesn't it, to create the kind of positive change that we're all hoping for.
Absolutely. And in fact, that is the other secret meaning of live to see it, which is simply to live your life with that vision in front of you, irrespective of whether you live long enough to see it realized or not. Just to live to see that before you, I think, is exactly the life that he led, and that when I say live to see it, I would encourage everybody to lead, to find your vision of what the world should be and walk towards that. And it seems to me
live
that's
forward.
What...
That's
what he was encouraging us all to do. So
yeah.
that raises the question. I wonder if you could take the proverbial time machine, go back and say, Dr. King, here you go. I'm going to take you 45 years into the future. Here's the Democratic National Convention taking place in my hometown, Denver, Colorado. And look, here is an African-American man accepting the nomination of the Democratic Party for the office of president. Would he say, the dream has been realized. The dream I was looking for has been realized.
It's a milestone along the road. I'm not sure that this country has gone, has the civil rights movement has been successful in so many ways. Open racists are beginning to be a little hard to find. You can find a few.
Which is a good thing.
Which is a good thing. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Because it's just not a good. I mean, it's just not a good way to live. To have that kind of hatred in your heart is just it's just a bad way to live. And so, I think that there have been other milestones along the way, but yeah, this is a pretty major one. And whether or not you vote for him, and I'm not going to, but the point is that it's a historic thing that's happening, and I believe also a historic thing that there's going to be a woman running on the Republican ticket. So I think it's a great day for our country, and a major milestone, I think, on the way to the Martin Luther King foresaw. So.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And I think that it raises the question for us as people who like to poke ahead and see where things are going to take us next, to wonder, well, what will the big diversity hurdle that we will have leaped over by 45 years from today be? And I see that in the chat room, they're jumping way ahead of us talking about augmented humans, and this is, I think, perhaps one direction that it could go. There are a number of possible futures for who gets viewed as PJ Manny spoke about once on the program. We were doing a panel with transhumanists about this notion of the other.
Yeah.
And as we grow more inclusive, at one time, a black man was the other to the extent that there was no way you would see someone like Barack Obama being the candidate for a major national party, or you know, a woman was even other to the extent that that you wouldn't expect to realistically see a woman become vice president of the United States. Apparently, we've stepped past that. So, who is the other that we will start to have to begin trying to draw into ourselves over the next 45 years? And I think you know, there are still lots of potential hurdles that can be leaped over just within the demographics that we currently have. You can say, well, when will we have our first, you know, gay presidential candidate, or when will we have, you know, actually, I was thinking about this earlier, and I believe when Joe Lieberman ran in 2000, that was the first time that a Jew had ever run for
vice president.
Of course,
John F. Kennedy was the first Catholic.
First Catholic. There you go. So, I mean,
yeah.
Some of these we've left over.
I think John Kerry
was
only the second Catholic to run.
And the first to actually achieve the office, yeah.
Yeah.
And there was some controversy over that at the time, but it didn't stop him from being elected.
Right.
And there was no controversy that I can recall over Lieberman, but that didn't stop him from being on the ticket that won the popular vote. As
Mitt Romney felt the need to basically do a speech very similar to JFK's about his religion. Of course, Mitt Romney is a Mormon.
Exactly.
He did a speech very, very similar to John Kennedy's speech, where he basically said, you know, this is how I believe, but how I'm not going to govern as a Catholic. I'm going to govern as John Kennedy. And Mitt Romney was saying basically the same thing. You know, they're not going to call the shots from Utah. You know, when I'm president, Mitt Romney will be the president, and I will not govern as a Mormon. You know, so
right.
It's interesting that he felt the need to do that. So yeah, there's like you say, there's still hurdles to cross, but.
And it just struck me that we may have actually seen the first cyborg president without realizing it.
How's that?
Explain.
Franklin Roosevelt, depending on the breadth of your definition of human augmentation, since he was unable to stand for any extended period of time on his own due to polio, he did have leg braces and was helped into place by them at a number of times on camera and on screen without the public knowing any different.
Yeah. No, the public was not aware, apparently, that he was in the wheelchair, was he?
And even if you don't make the cyborg leap, which Stephen, you had pointed out earlier, would also apply to our current vice president Dick Cheney,
right?
Pacemaker
is
a cyborg as well.
Was it defibrillator pacemaker defibrillator combination?
Exactly. Yeah.
Yep.
So he's wired. I was going to say for FDR, the other hurdle that was crossed there, although it had to be crossed secretly, it had to be crossed without people knowing it, was that we had a disabled person who was president of the United States, served as president for longer than anyone else has ever served as president of the United States from a wheelchair, which is really a wonderful thing that he was able to do it.
I wonder in this day and age whether, you know, certainly it couldn't be a secret anymore. If John McCain were in a wheelchair, for example, you know, there's no keeping that a secret in this day and age. So
that's
would America openly elect a disabled person? I don't know.
I'm not sure either.
A person, perhaps.
And again, then that would be one of the hurdles that we'll probably leap over in the next 45 years, or
right.
that will no longer be an issue. And I think once you start looking at issues around genetically modified people, or people who are cyborgs in the sense that they've got the kind of brain implants or augmentation that we were talking about on the program last week, or when you have a situation where artificial intelligence is making the case for its own humanity,
right.
when those things actually become issues, probably a lot of the rest of this stuff just won't matter anymore, right? You say, well, I you know, disabled, Muslim, gay, transgendered, you know, there's going to be basically if you're a mosh, and that is the mostly original substrate human, we're all, you know, we're all part of the same group because there's now this new other, which is an augmented human or a human who is, you know, in some fundamental
a person
different
that's
from,
built from scratch, you know, not part of the genetic gene pool at all.
Exactly.
Yeah. Completely.
So, yeah. So all of those, all of those could be could be potential issues around diversity for the future.
Yeah, I'm reminded, of course, of your declaration of singularity that you ought to link to when we're doing the show notes here. That. Basically talks about that. So,
yeah, in fact, well, we're on this journey as humanity from pre-humanity to our current state, and you know, it's like we're kind of passing through different stages of technological development and as society, social development, and I think that. How we relate to each other is definitely going to be impacted by how we view each other and by who makes up the whole the whole spectrum of who we're interacting with as humans, or even if the word human doesn't apply anymore, as beings who are part of our you know, part of our civilization. To the extent that when we can look at an artificial intelligence, or when we can talk to an augmented person, someone who's who is, you know, in some sense fundamentally different from us, and yet feel that we're in a more important sense the same as those people, I think that certainly diversity within the human species becomes a lot less important at that point.
Yeah.
To the point that that it won't even matter anymore.
Right. If you find a kindred spirit who happens to be an AI. You know, yeah, that's a lot of the other things that have kept us separate from one another might seem silly after that. So, yeah, I see that.
As Harvey says, people are people.
Yeah.
I think that's
the
idea.
You go, what's the...
Well, wherever you go, there you are. That's the old buckaroo
right.
Bonsai, and I think that's exactly right. People are people, and we're gonna extend our definition of people just as we always have. Just as you know, the ancient Greeks had this idea of barbarians who they didn't even consider them to be human, and barbarian just meant, you know, anybody who wasn't Greek. We're gonna extend our idea of who people are through accepting others, but I think we're just about there on that one. I think it's going to be these new folks who show up. Now, the other question, the related question is, what happens when there is a palpable difference in capability between ourselves and some of these later emerging intelligences? And we've talked about the movie Gattaca before, where you have a society in which the augmented, improved humans, the genetically perfect humans, run the show, and people like us, the mostly original substrate humans, the people who are just plain humans, are kind of the persecuted minority.
Well, I'm hopeful that, obviously I'm hopeful that it doesn't develop quite like that, and that people that, you know, are able to upgrade, at, you know, no matter how they're born, they're able to upgrade later. The movie Gattaca, you know, imagines a future where you can genetically engineer people and then, you know, and give birth to somebody who's genetically engineered. But if you're born, you know, like a normal human, then, you know, you're basically, you know, you're out of luck. And I'm hopeful that that won't be the case, that there'll be ways of, you know, joining the mainstream at that point, regardless of how you got here.
Yeah, I think so too. I think that there will be options for us, I think the same is true if you're talking about artificial intelligence and you're talking about a post-singularity world. I mean, one of the images that people often throw out there is that you know, the singularity occurs, then you've got these artificial intelligences, and, you know, I, for one, welcome our new robotic overlords kind of picture of how the world might be working with. Basically, they're a million times faster than us, and they're running the show. What I talk about in the Declaration of Singularity and what I hope will occur and what we should be working towards occurring is that when those artificial intelligences show up and make that leap, that we're welcome to come along. That they are us, that they consider themselves part of our civilization, part of our species, and that where they go, we're welcome to come too, rather than just leaving us behind or ruling over us. However, in however a friendly manner or however an intimidating manner, people might picture that. So that's certainly what I'm hoping for. That they don't stay the other forever. And in fact, if we start thinking of them as not other now, I think we've got a much better chance of and that applies both to augmented humans and to artificial intelligence. I think if we start thinking of them as something other than other, which would be, you know, the other of my other is me, right? If we start thinking of them as us, they will be us.
Yeah. We can avoid the possibility of Austrian bodybuilders, you know, cyborg Austrian bodybuilders taking over the world.
We don't need that.
I'll
for
be
sure.
Back.
All right. Well, this is Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. We're talking about the future of diversity, and we're going to talk a little bit of energy policy now. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can give us a call at 347-215-8972 or join us on our online chat. And, yeah, this is what I wanted to get into because, you know, we spoke a while back about with the presidential race shaping up. We had listened to right around the anniversary of Yuri Gagarin's historic flight.
Right.
We had talked about the speech that John F. Kennedy, President Kennedy, gave before a joint session of Congress, in which he proposed the moon flight. And we had a snatch from a speech he gave a while later at Rice University, which kind of encapsulates his idea around where we needed to go. So let's listen to President Kennedy on going to the moon.
We choose to go to the moon. We choose to go to the moon. We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things, not because they are easy, but because they are hard. Because that goal will serve to organize and measure the best of our energies and skills, because that challenge is one that we're willing to accept, one we are unwilling to postpone, and one we intend to win, and the others too.
All right, so that was President Kennedy speaking at Rice University, 1961, I believe, talking about the imperative of going to the moon. We choose to go to the moon, outlining his vision for why it was good for us as a country to do that. The best in our skills, it would challenge us. And we said we'd like to hear something like that from somebody running for president.
And you had asked me, Phil, you know, what big goal would be appropriate, and I had said energy. You know, I would like to, you know, we choose to be energy independent. And then lo and behold, we heard that, didn't we?
Well, here we go. This is from Thursday night. This is Barack Obama speaking to the Democratic National Convention.
And for the sake of our economy, our security, and the future of our planet, I will set a clear goal as president. In 10 years, we will finally end our dependence on oil from the Middle East. Now is the time to end this addiction. And to understand that drilling is a stopgap measure, not a long-term solution, not even close. As president, I will tap our natural gas reserves, invest in clean coal technology, and find ways to safely harness nuclear power. I'll help our auto companies retool so that the fuel-efficient cars of the future are built right here in America. I'll make it easier for the American people to afford these new cars. And I'll invest $150 billion over the next decade in affordable, renewable sources of energy, wind power and solar power, and the next generation of biofuels, an investment that will lead to new industries and 5 million new jobs that pay well and can't be outsourced.
That played a little louder than I was hoping that it would. I had adjusted the volume on that before the program, and somehow it went back up to the higher level of volume, but still. So here's Barack Obama, Senator Obama, outlining his vision for, to answer, Michael, your question, 10 years to oil independence. Well, that's how I read it. That's how I heard it. And that's how I blogged about it in Better All the Time, only to have a commenter point out that he did not say we would be completely independent from imported oil. What he said was oil from the Middle East, which actually only makes up about 16% of our oil imports. So what I took to be an extremely broad and expansive goal, 10 years to get us completely off foreign oil, is not quite as expansive as I thought. It's 10 years to get us off. In fact, I had a commenter on the blog give me a little more information on this. Basically, he wants to get us off Middle Eastern and Venezuelan fossil fuel within 10 years. Still worthy goals. They get us so that we're not buying oil and natural gas from people who don't have our best interests at heart, which I think is what most people would agree about the governments in the Middle East and certainly in Venezuela. But it's not the big choose to go to the moon vision that I thought he was outlining at first. What do you think, Stephen? What do you think of that as a goal, getting us off Middle Eastern?
It's an excellent goal. It's an excellent goal. And this election has been, both of the candidates, John McCain and Barack Obama, have both spent a lot of time talking about energy. I think the political class is beginning to get it, that how important energy is to this country. It is the lifeblood of our economy, and without it, without energy, we grind to a halt, and many of the freedoms that we hold dear would go with it. We have to have the energy, and I suspect that when John McCain gives his speech, he'll spend some time outlining an energy program as well.
Well, I think he will too, and let's motivate him for that a little bit, because I wanted to mention what we're doing. Let me just step back a moment and say that we did have a winner of our highly coveted Fast Forward Radio coffee mug last week, and that winner is Leslie Kirshner, whom I've been trying to reach to let her know that she's won and to get that mug to her. Haven't been able to reach her yet. Leslie, if you're listening, use the email address on the home page of the Speculist blog, blog.speculist.com. Drop us a line, and we'll get that mug to you. Brian Wang also received one, and that has been sent. So, speaking of mugs, now, of course, as you know, we at Fast Forward Radio and the Speculist do not do politics, so we will not be endorsing either candidate for president. However, what we have decided to do is the presidential candidate, the campaign that outlines the program with the highest speculist appeal, we're going to send them a Fast Forward Radio coffee mug.
And so John McCain, the gauntlet has been thrown down. Barack Obama,
that's right,
says we're going to get off Middle Eastern oil, and we're going to develop nuclear, and we're going, and what else do you say, Phil?
He said plug-in hybrids. I'm sure your ears perked up with that one. He's going to put a million plug-in hybrids on the road.
That's a big one for me.
Yeah. Or actually, I don't know if he said that, but that's in the notes that I received from the Obama volunteer who left comments. He wants to get us on plug-in hybrids. He did mention nuclear, which I think is a new thing coming from the Democratic side of the side.
Which
of the
I think is remarkable. I think that's a remarkable change. Democrats have long, had in their under their tent. The Greens, people that are concerned about the environment and that who have long been very much against nuclear power. I think these environmental people are beginning to understand that nuclear can be clean and safe and more environmentally sound than perhaps any other energy we can produce.
Well, absolutely. I think that message is getting out there, and I think when you look at the balance, between risks which appear to have been mitigated considerably for nuclear power,
right,
and the risk of going forward into the future and not producing our own power and having others dictate our future for us based on the fact that we're sending them all our money for our energy, the equation really starts to look different. And I think that's what Senator Obama's position on this recognizes that. So I think that's great. And he is in the lead, for the mug right now. He's come out to an early lead, but the Republican convention is coming up, and of course we still got the debates. And I don't think we'll actually announce a winner of the coffee mug until probably right before the election. So we'll give them both plenty of time. If you're listening, Senator McCain, ball's in your court. What do you got? Right now the mug's going the other way. So hopefully he's going to come back with something even more. We choose to go to the moon than the
speculatastic.
Yes, very good. Yes,
that's the word we want.
Lurific. Yes, we're. Oh wait, I know the word. It's speculicious. That's the word.
That's right.
We want more good speculicious programs, and the idea is, of course, that we would encourage both parties. We would encourage supporters of Senator McCain and supporters of Senator Obama to think about how technology, how a positive view of the future, how working towards positive ends can give us new possibilities for solving our problems. And my great hope is that if more of these ideas get into the discourse on both sides, then that increases the chance that whoever gets elected, we're going to see some of these kinds of policies get implemented.
I guess I should point out for McCain that obviously he has talked with and or read the book of Robert Zubrin and his flex fuel ideas.
Yes, who was a guest on this program back in December of last year, I should point
that's
out.
That's right, and because right after he was a guest on our program, there was a Republican debate that included McCain and the other Republican candidates where McCain basically outlined Zubrin's plan almost right down the line. So McCain is aware of that and would like to implement flex fuel.
It was very exciting to hear him say that. Then now that he's officially or almost officially the Republican candidate, we need to hear him get back on the board with that now that he's actually the guy who's carrying the Republican banner. And I hope to hear that. I'll tell you what, if he comes out with the flex fuel thing, he might be nudging that cup away. But then, of course, Senator Obama will still have plenty of chances to come back with, these can be other ideas too. It's not just energy, right?
Right.
If one of them comes out with a really strong policy towards developing friendly AI or building a space elevator, I'll tell you what, if either one of them says space elevator, I think they've just about
they win automatically.
The coffee mug. Yeah.
and the thing is, you don't have to win the election to win our coffee mug.
That's right. Good point.
You know.
you come up with the most speculative program and you win the coffee mug, irrespective of the electoral or popular vote. Either way, we're rewarding ideas here, not electoral success, because that that kind of has its own reward, right? I mean, so there's two big prizes you're going for right now: President of the United States and the speculative coffee mug. Okay, so I'm not saying which is bigger, which is more important. I think we both know, but I'm just saying
that coffee tastes awfully good out of that mug. So
well, as Harvey will tell you, it just makes all the difference, I think. And I still don't have one, Stephen. I don't know if you've gotten yourself one yet, but I think that
the order has been placed.
Oh, has it? Oh, good man. All right. So you know, you'll be able to speak knowledgeably about what a difference it's made in your life to actually have a Fast Forward Radio coffee mug. Well, I'm going to say that this is Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network, and we're going to go an extra 15 minutes this evening just because we had one more segment that we wanted to get to, and we're having so much fun that how could we stop now? So if you'd like to join us as we talk about various topics in the future, you can give us a call at 347-215-8972. Now, our next topic, beyond all this politics and diversity and stuff, let's do something a little Labor Day. And I thought we could do the future barbecue, which would be a good Labor Day topic. But why don't we talk?
Hey, the thing about barbecue is it's perfected now. You know, the future of barbecue, my hope for barbecue is it'll be the same in 20 years as it is today. Cause it's pretty
yeah,
and we should
exactly
right.
Right. Yeah.
Before we get into the partisan element of that discussion.
Oh yeah, that's true.
Okay, well we're not going to endorse either. We're not going to endorse either charcoal or gas. Okay, if that's what you're talking about, Michael. Although I do not have a gas grill and will not allow one in my home. Okay, but we're not going to get into that is a big
Apple
a big
wood.
Partisan debate.
Apple wood is the way to go.
Oh, there you go. Okay,
so fruit wood.
I think we're on the same page. Michael, are you a gas grill guy?
Charcoal all the way.
All right, so good. Now, okay, we can actually go partisan on this one. All right, so we won't go partisan on presidential politics, but the future of barbecue is they're going to ban gas grills, I think. We need that natural gas to make into methanol to run in our flex fuel vehicles, and people should be using charcoal, wood. As you mentioned, apple wood is good. Depending on the meat, you might also try hickory. There are a number of different woods for different flavors, but I think we're all in agreement that gas is for weenies.
What's the name of that character in that show? Propane.
Hank Hill.
Hank Hill.
Yeah, there you go.
Taste the meat, not the heat.
There you go. Okay, well, we certainly don't want to take money out of the pocket of all the Hankels in the world, so we can support diversity and everything else. I think we're not going to make the other out of people with gas grills. So I retract what I said, and there's, you know, Fast Forward Radio is
taste, though.
Yeah, it's a big tent radio program, and there's room for all. Well, just like we're not endorsing any candidates, but as you pointed out, you're probably going to vote one way or the other. I'm going to vote one way or the other. Michael Darling, if he were here, I think would tell you how he's going to vote. And Michael Sargent, I believe you've probably already made up your mind how you're going to vote.
I have.
Yeah. So, you know, it's not that we don't have opinions on these things. It's just that we don't make them part of the show. And so I now retract what I said about gas grills. And I want to talk about not the future barbecue, in fact, but the future of labor, since it's Labor Day. Let's talk a little bit about the future of work. And where is work going? And I would start this off by saying, you know, there was a time, maybe at the turn of the previous century, around the heyday of the Industrial Revolution, when people looked at automation and they said, you know, what's going to happen is they're going to automate all the jobs out of existence. And we see something very similar happening in our era with computer technology, where jobs get, through electronics, get automated out of existence. And there was this notion that labor would disappear completely, machines would do all the work, and people would all live a life of leisure. That idea certainly was not realized, that scenario was not realized in the 20th century. And my question is that a more realistic scenario for the 21st century, or is it completely unrealistic to talk in terms of labor going away because of automation or for any other reason?
Well, one of the things about labor is that it's one of the ways that we come to value ourselves as people is that we participate in the world and we do creative things and we do productive things, and drudge work, the type of work that that nobody wants to do and everyone hates, you know, maybe that can be automated out of existence, but creative work and work that people actually enjoy doing, why would we want to automate that out of existence? You know, I would say that. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Oh no, I was just going to say that I see that that Michael has written, if your job can be reduced to an algorithm, it will be done by a computer. So that's the argument. Currently, to date, most of the jobs that have been replaced by machines have been what you're talking about, drudge work. And I see that Harvey in the chat room is talking about miners, right? We think about we'll send robots down to do all the mining, and then we don't have people caught in the mines or any of that kind of stuff. I mean, the self-serve gas pump is actually a piece of automation that replaced a job. Right?
Right.
Not that great of a job that people didn't really aspire to by and large. And so it was replaced by automation. But as algorithms get more sophisticated, we now have algorithms doing financial trading, very sophisticated financial analysis and trading, much faster and to a much more sophisticated degree than human traders were able to do it. And that is something that we would have thought of as a human job. Even maybe 10, 15 years ago, and now it's being taken over by, as Michael points out, algorithms. Well, what does that say about other jobs? I mean, Stephen, you're a lawyer. How far are we from algorithms that that can practice law? And if computers can practice law, will that eliminate the job of lawyer as we know it? What do you think?
Well, you know, there are like services where people get online and, you know, can download wills that, you know, by and large, are pretty good wills. But, you know, another term for an attorney is counselor. And
okay.
I think that, you know, when people have a problem, they tend to want to go and sit face-to-face with someone and that is knowledgeable in how to handle that problem and talk it out. I don't see that going away anytime soon. And there's not a real easy algorithm, I don't think, that could be written for that. And so, you know, certainly one-on-one contact like that with an individual, that's going to be with us a little while longer, I would think. So I think that attorneys are one of those jobs that will be around a little while.
Okay. All right. Michael, you're saying?
Had you heard about the controversy in Australia recently over a legal expert system that claims to be capable of rendering legal opinions based on the logic of the evidence presented?
I had not, Michael. You got a link for that? We need to get that in the show notes.
I'm going to have to reach out for that one and see if I can find it, but it's about 6 or 8 months old. And
now, surely as a lawyer, Stephen, you would agree that they'll automate judges long before they'll automate lawyers. Or maybe you can't agree to that.
No, I can't agree to that. Your Honor, if you're listening, you will never be replaced.
That was Phil who said that, and I was just kidding. But am I right in thinking, Michael, that what they're talking about is automating a judge, not a lawyer? Is that correct?
My impression was that it was a supplemental process. Something that a law office would use to build a case or someone might use to consult in the early stages of developing a case on their own and then bring that particular knowledge to their barrister of choice.
Interesting. Okay. But still,
yeah,
you
I would
get
definitely
that.
Want to read that, Michael. So, yeah,
yeah,
if you can find
that. But you still wouldn't get what Stephen's talking about, which is the face-to-face, the actual the feeling that you're, you know, being heard and being understood and being sympathized with by someone who empathizes with you, right?
Well,
that whole experience is going to...
Stephen might agree with me is the better part of the business of law as opposed to the drudgery of research and the tedium of legal reasoning.
Yeah, perhaps the best part of practicing law will remain, and some of the tedious aspects can be automated. Yeah, absolutely. I can see that.
Okay, so that's Stephen's job. Looks like secure for now. Not going to be automated out of existence. Well, let's go to mine. I'm in marketing, and here's the great thing is that they could probably have computers doing marketing now, but it's completely subjective by and large whether a particular marketing campaign is any good, and only marketing people can really say whether it's any good or not. So we'll just keep saying the computers aren't doing a very good job, you know, as long as we have the power to do that. And so they're not going to be kicking us out anytime.
Well, y'all don't have objective metrics. I mean, you look and say, okay, before the advertising campaign, we were only selling X number of widgets, and now we're selling more or 2X.
Of course, you do have those. I'm going to get myself in as much trouble as I got you probably over the judge thing. let's just say that stuff, you know, by some less scrupulous marketing people, not myself or any of the people I work with, can be finessed to a certain extent.
Yeah.
Meantime, Harvey is asking for something that's slightly easier. He'd like a fuel pump bot that will take the cap off and do the pumping for him. And I think British Petroleum or Shell debuted one of those in Europe last year. And then also farm equipment, automated farm equipment.
Yeah.
Automated, it's fully automated farm equipment, right? Because,
yeah,
I mean, to a certain extent.
Plow the field with no farmer in the tractor, huh?
Well,
right.
And it's getting
yeah.
to that point now. With GPS in the tractor, you are supervising the machinery, but generally not in control most of the time.
There you go. Well, one of the things that's interesting about automation is that a lot of times when jobs are automated, they haven't actually saved the average person that much labor. When you think about automation like the vacuum cleaner, the washer dryer, the dishwasher, you think about the gas pump or the self checkout stand at the supermarket. You know, these were all things that supposedly make the environment much more productive. But what happened is we went from a model where people had someone come into their home and sweep and do the dishes for them and, you know, all that kind of stuff, to one where people did that for themselves because they had all these machines that would allow them to do it, right? You went from a model where you sat in your car and said, fill her up, to one where you had to get out of your car, grab the pump, stick it right. And I think that you know, a big part of the labor gets automated, and then a smaller part gets pushed back off onto us. And so one of the reasons that that labor probably won't disappear altogether is because as things get automated, we take on a certain share of what's been automated. Another example for people who work in offices, there was a time when virtually anyone who worked in an office setting had some kind of administrative assistant or secretary or some kind of assistant who typed things up for you, made copies for you, all that kind of stuff. Anymore, almost everyone except for the highest level executives does that kind of stuff for themselves, right? I mean, well, we're all on email now, so you know, you don't have this business of dictating correspondence.
There's no typing pool anymore, yeah.
There's no typing pool. We're all our own typing pool. We're all on keyboards all the time. We're writing our own stuff. So everyone became their own secretary. You know, everyone has become their own, to a certain extent, housekeeper. Everyone is their own gas pumper. So there's this interesting kind of relationship between labor disappearing as jobs, but sticking around as something that we have to do for ourselves. And I think that probably won't go away at all.
Well, and to add
except for I hope Harvey gets his, you know, I don't have to get out of the car gas pump, because that would be pretty handy.
And to add on to that, how about the recent renaissance in the do-it-yourself spirit, the makers and the gadgeteers who make a hobby of things that once were full-time jobs?
Well, give us an example of that.
Yeah.
For example, the website make.com is centered around the types of people who will build from scratch their own computers, their own pipe organs, motorcycles, bicycles, all of this kind of fabrication and actual hands-on bending has become something of a renewed study in American culture.
That would be a cool thing to do, just, you know, so you could say you did it. This, you know, this mountain bike that I'm riding, I built it from scratch.
Built it myself. There you go.
Yeah, I even bent the tubes and did the, yeah, cool.
But, of course,
yeah.
At that point, what we're talking about is labor being transformed to recreation.
Right.
These people aren't doing this as their livelihood. They don't need to do this. They're doing it because they think it's fun. Is that, am I capturing the spirit of that correctly, Michael?
essentially, it's done primarily for fun, sometimes for economy.
Oh, okay. Yeah, you do it because you can get a better deal on it. Okay, I can see that. So, but between those two concerns, it's not that
actually,
they're doing
I would
it
think
because
that usually you'd spend more money. I'm sure you'd spend more money, say, building a bicycle from scratch than you would going down and picking up a Schwinn.
Unless you were building it from discarded parts from the junk dealer down the street.
Yeah.
Well, there you go. And I think that the idea that people adopt labor as recreation is one of the possible futures for labor. The other one is that enough of the drudgery gets automated to the point where we're all doing, Stephen, as you talked about, the fun and interesting parts of our job. At which point do we reach this very happy place where labor and leisure become indistinguishable?
Right.
For example, if my job were doing the speculist and doing fast forward radio, if I were actually earning my livelihood doing that, well, this is what I currently do for fun. I currently do this because I enjoy it. If I were to reach the point where that activity was the one that I did for my livelihood, would I be engaging in labor or would I be engaging in leisure?
It wouldn't matter anymore, would it?
That's right. That distinction wouldn't exist anymore.
That's right. And if anyone wants to, you know, like General Motors or anybody wants to adopt this program, you know, we can be had for the right price.
Absolutely. We're available. You know, give us a call. I give the number all the time. You can leave comments. Hey, we're ready to talk. We're ready to negotiate on exactly that point.
Exactly. Yeah,
right,
blending your work and fun, that's a huge part of where we're going with work. I'd say the other thing is that I see a time in the near future where jobs are farmed out to such an extent that we might be working for one firm for one little project, you know, for a few hours in the morning and for some other company we've never worked for before and never even heard of before in the afternoon doing some other project.
I think a lot of people work that way now. I think
there's a
lot of that going on now. And you're right. We might reach the point where virtually that's the model everyone follows.
Yeah.
That's certainly what, you know, as you see the increased connectedness between people that the Internet allows and the reduction in transaction costs and going out and finding exactly the right person to do exactly the task you're looking for, that's kind of the model that we would move towards.
That's right. That would be the ultimate result of telecommuting. So, yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And what a difference between that and the old model of, you know, you find yourself a good job at a good company and you work there for whatever, 40, 45 years till you get the
gold watch and retire. Yeah.
Yeah. Almost the complete opposite of that. Well, I think we've shot just a little bit past our time, so I'm going to wrap us up on the subject of labor versus leisure. Michael, unless there were any other thoughts from the chat room that anyone wanted to share?
Harvey says recreational labor sounds a lot more interesting than a treadmill, and I have to agree with that.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, we'll see what the future unfolds for us on this road from labor to leisure. So everyone, think about that a little bit as you take tomorrow off. You know, what are you doing for fun, and what component of that might be part of your job? Yeah, somewhere down the road. Absolutely. Well, let's talk about music now, Stephen. What are we going to be listening to this evening?
The band is Black Lab, and the song is "See the Sun."
See the Sun by Black Lab. And we will listen to that. I will do my best. I'm no Stephen Gordon, but I'm going to do my best to get some show notes up here before long. So hopefully within the next day or so, we'll see show notes for this program. Stephen, thank you very much. Michael, thanks to you and to all our friends in the chat room and to everyone listening. Thank you for being a part of Fast Forward Radio. We look forward to being with you again very soon. Good night.
feel the strength.